right, we're back. So let's start out with the Eric Chavez podcast, EC to the three. And then I'll get to some of your mailbag. I don't want to spend the whole segment on Chavez, but I figured I'd do about 15 minutes. And I pulled up a bunch of clips, and I listened to the whole podcast. I actually listened to it twice because I wanted to make sure I was fair. Because I think that Chavez, who was not a beloved coach in the Mets organization, and by the way, if you read Andy Martino's book, The Yankee Way, was very well respected when he got into baseball as a former player. And the Yankees really liked him. And the reason he came up with the Mets on the Epler is because he got a promotion. He was just an advisor with the Yankees. And he has had aspirations, and he brings it up in this podcast to manage. Now, let me lay out where I think the Chavez and Chavez's interactions with the fans and his podcast and what he's put out there and his attacks on analytics and David Stearns. And most of what he puts out on that show, I'm not really sure really matters or is well thought out or is logic that stands the test of really diving and peeling the onion there. But there's a couple of things he brought up that I think are important and concerning and maybe things that we should keep an eye on going forward with the Mets. But let me explain to you. I think Eric Chavez is the poster child of a lot of players that retired that were from the late 80s, 90s, turn of the century. Let's say players that probably retired somewhere on the 2010-ish era. Analytics really exploded post-2010. Yeah, there was Billy Bean, there was the A's, they were the team using it, the Red Sox and Theo Epstein. The things that those guys were doing compared to what has gone on now and where it's been taken now, that's like, actually, I would tell you, if you ran your club like the Red Sox in 2004 or the A's in 2003 or the Moneyball year 2004, I think you'd be considered old school by today's analytics standards. I do. I think the Rays have taken to another level, and the Dodgers and a lot of the newer front office exec type. So what I think is that Chavez is rallying for coaches and managerial candidates and players that, quite honestly, are getting pushed out of the game because the game is becoming complicated. The problem that I think baseball has, and maybe the media is overplaying it, but the front office is the story, not the players on the field, not the manager in the dugout, and that is a problem. The fact that fans know Andrew Friedman, David Stearns, Brian Cashman, I could go on and on and on. I bet you if you have a lot of young fans, they'd be able to name executives on teams versus managers is a problem. Because when I was a kid, and even going into when I started this 20 years ago, yeah, you had Omar Minaya and you had the front office, and in New York, the GMs and were always on the spotlight. But you didn't talk about Frank Cashin back in the day all the time. You didn't talk about Steve Phillips all the time back in the 90s. It was about Bobby V in the dugout. It was about the manager. And the only time Steve Phillips was on the story was when he made a trade or when he fired the manager or he was fighting with Bobby V. And that's more of a New York thing. I think across the league, a lot of these GMs back in the day were former players. They weren't Harvard executives. They weren't guys that, or have people in their front office that used to work for Goldman Sachs or were data analysts or scientists. You know, the level of data analysis, these are high-level scientist types. Probably sound like a knuckle-dragger saying it that way, but I'm a radio guy, right? So I think he's putting it out there, a plea almost, like he's reacting because he thinks he's going to be extinct, and he's probably right. Now, I think throughout the podcast, Chavez does not necessarily give you any indication that he's willing to meet these guys halfway. It's his way or the highway. And if you're going to be in a modern front office, you have to sell your thoughts in context of their philosophy. And I'll get to that in a minute because the most concerning thing I have is about a hitting philosophy. Now, Chavez does not really articulate his alternative, but I do believe if the hitting philosophy is just hitting home runs or, you know, striking out or just hitting the ball hard as you can and launching it, I think you're going to get a lot of what you see with Alvarez and Vientos and to a certain extent Beatty. Failed prospects. Now, Benjamin Ewing, who were coming up through the same organization, but have come up through the minors, whereas Beatty, Alvarez, Vientos have been through a couple of different regimes, you don't seem to see the same problem. I mean, Ewing, who's not a guy that was advertised with power, is showing pretty good power. Benj as well. And it's very exciting to see these two kids and what they can be in the anchor of the offense along with Lindor and Soto and potentially Bichette, like I said. So let's start out now. He doesn't think, Chavez, that Mendoza should have been fired. But when you listen to him, and I'll play the clip line now first, then I'll comment.
Yeah, I don't even know. Let's just start at the beginning, Carlos. We had a history when I worked with the Yankees organization. I love Carlos. When he came over, we interviewed, we talked. It was instant. I knew, first of all, I already knew I would like the man. I knew working under Boone for all those years as the bench coach, learning from him, who I really respect the way Aaron Boone goes about his business. I respect, you know, even Cashman, the whole Yankee organization, I think, is extremely well run. And I think every organization should, you know, look to them as how to do it right, right? Cashman's been there for 30 plus years, whatever, multiple World Series. They go to the playoffs every year. They develop players. They draft well. They just do it right, you know? And I think every organization to look to this. I instantly knew I wanted to stay with Carlos. We hit it off right away. You know, we make that run. You know, Carlos was the right guy. You know, in a tough city, being a bench coach going to manager, that's a completely different seat. But he's a good baseball man. He's just a great individual. There's no reason why, you know, he wasn't capable of being the leader. He took us to the ALCS in his first year.
Yeah, in the NLCS,
so
yeah.
He has the pedigree. He knows the game. He knows how to deal with people. And this was the wrong fire.
Why?
Let's just get right to it.
Yeah, Stearns, no, why? Like, why was it the wrong move, and why do you think it happened?
Stearns was the wrong hire, and I think, you know, we can kind of dive into, you know, his huge contract, 5 years, $50 million.
All right, stop. So there was really nothing about Carlos Mendoza to make you feel like he was the right guy. Then he came from the Yankees organization and he likes the Yankees organization. And then he talks about Stearns right away and he brings up Stearns' contract and money, which now you're starting to hear why some of the resentment towards Stearns getting paid all this money. Clearly it's not been the best second half. I mean, this has been going on well over a year now. The Mets have been a 90-loss team. The Mets are on a 90-loss pace in the back half of 25. They're on a 90-95 loss pace this year. That's a year of baseball that's a trend. It's not just a bad stretch like we were talking about last year. So there's really nothing that Chavez talks about in terms of Mendoza being the right hire. He goes into, and I'll play that, Epler, and Epler getting canned, and a little bit of a cryptic that it was an inside job. So let's listen to what he has to say there about Epler.
He put him in a position that, I mean, there was some overlap between Epler and Stearns, right? So you have the overlap situation. Yeah. So, like, take me to when this is all going down, what everybody's thinking. Like, is this is going to go horribly wrong, or maybe this guy knows what he's doing? Was it bad from the get?
I mean, Cohen had the right guy. He had Epler. You know, if he would still be there, there was an inside hit job that got Billy fired. Complete BS situation. I'm not going to dive into that. But he had the right guy. Yeah, go ahead.
So when you say a hit job, right, like there were people actively playing politics behind the scenes to run him out. And was it Stearns that likely was the puppet master of that he could get all the control?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. He came into a situation that was the fire was lit prior to him getting there. You know, I think Steve kind of knew, you know, that he wanted to go with Stearns. This was well documented. Grew up a New York's Met fans. I don't know why that would even matter. They don't have the greatest of history of love and winning. And
yeah, sure.
So
no,
I'm not sure that was the right, you know, part of the equation. But yeah, I was optimistic because I didn't know David. I had some people talk to me about him. There was some good, some bad. But I was optimistic. I think anytime you start something new, and everything was kind of fresh. Carlos was hired. David was coming in. You're optimistic, you know. And when you have an owner like Steve Cohen, and by the way, can we stop with the Steve Cohen needs to go. Not that is every team should want an owner.
Yeah,
like
the spins this dough. Guy, he's willing to spend the money to win.
He's emotionally involved. He really wants this team to win, and I honestly believe he's going to get there at some point. You know, and like I said, I just don't know where he got the advice that Stearns was going to be the guy. It's plain and simple, he's not. He's made a lot of mistakes, right?
So again, likes Epler probably because he knows him for many, many years. Likes him because he came from or grew up through the Yankees organization. Epler was railroaded. I thought the Stearns Epler and Epler being the GM, I think that point made by Chavez, that might have worked. That might have been a good yin and yang. And it's funny because Epler, when Joe Torre was the manager of the Yankees, he was considered too analytics driven. When he was with the Yankees and Joe Torre wrote about it in the Torre years, he was considered back then the outsider. Now Epler's like mainstream. So it goes back to my point. It's the evolution of the new guard versus the old guard. And is the new guard taking it too far? Because if Billy Epler during his Yankee tenure was considered a guy that didn't understand the heartbeat of a player, and I didn't see that as who he was the brief time he was general manager, then where are we now? I mean, imagine where we are now. But it's interesting that Epler was railroaded. He didn't get into that. There's been speculation that maybe because Buck didn't get along with him, maybe it was Buck, but nobody's ever really confirmed that. I'm assuming it's somebody still in the organization. I wonder what Epler did to somebody. It's interesting that nobody's been able to figure that out. The Mets are pretty good at keeping leaks down because during the Wilpon years, eventually that would have came out. And more than likely, it would have been Jeff Wilpon that caused the problems. But, you know, that goes back to it. I think that so far, he doesn't like Stearns because he's educated. He doesn't like Stearns because he's making money. Likes Epler. All due respect, the Epler team in 23 was a short-term situation. It was built on older, aging pitchers and component players that are at the end of the line. You got a couple of good years out of Marte. You got the last juice out of Escobar for a year. Same thing with Canna. You have not seen any draft. I think Ewing was part of the Epler draft, so maybe you want to give him some credit there. McLean, I believe, was a Stearns draft, not an Epler draft. Let me check on that. Nolan McLean draft. I think he was 24. No, he was actually the Epler 23. Tommy Tanis. It's truly the truth. The Mets draft in 2023. I mean, so far you've got McLean and you got Ewing. So not too bad. So you got to give Epler some credit there. Maybe that was the yin and the yang that the Mets needed. And it's a shame at that point. Now, he goes on to talk about Soto in the clubhouse. And to me, this next clip, when he talks about Soto, and I think it's Beltran, who is the front office executive. This is Mendoza. This is on Mendoza. If Lindor and Soto were chilly, and there were reports today, as recently as today, that Mendoza did try to bring these two guys together. But introducing Soto into that clubhouse, that was part of Mendoza's job. And that was conversations that he should have had. And maybe he took for granted how easy it would be for somebody coming across town, making the old-time contract that he's making, that was known to be a guy that was a workman-like baseball cage rat, to all of a sudden be a leader. Like, so you're hearing that the players don't know who to go to for leadership. There's really, and I mean, usually there's a core group of veterans that are the leaders. Right now, it sounds like it's Lindor and Soto figuring things out. And, you know, now you have guys on short-term deals because Pete's gone, McNeil's gone, Nimmo's gone. So maybe, but it sounds like even before they were gone, maybe that was shielded because those other guys were here. So that'll be interesting how that plays out. I think Soto's going to be a leader by example. He's going to go, he's going to hit, he's going to put up Hall of Fame numbers. I don't think he's going to ignore the rest of the team, but I think he's going to be so focused on himself and his game that I'm not sure he's going to be the emotional, vocal leader that necessarily fans look to and is always front-facing. And that's where Lindor would be. But I also wonder if Lindor's skill sets are eroding. Because at some point, to be a leader but not be one of the better players on the team, you could be a voice and an important voice, but you're not the best player on the team. You're not a core. I shouldn't say the best player on the team. You're not a core player. Right now, he is. Let's see what he's going to be going for. All right, let's play the Soto clip now.
And I love Juan, by the way. Juan will give you the shirt off his back. I think he's one of the coolest human beings just a really good person. But he struggled the first 2 months emotionally, right? And I don't blame him. Big move going from the Yankees. Maybe had a little bit of buyer's remorse. It's all going to work out. Juan's going to the Hall of Fame. You know, I even tabbed him to be an MVP type of player, and he's going off. Like, he's hitting-wise, he's unreal. But he struggled. And in between innings, he would run from the outfield and go sit in the batting cage on a couch and not be in the dugout with a teammate, right? And like I said, I'm not throwing Juan. This isn't a Juan issue, right? This is a leadership, lack of leadership, lack of accountability from the top down. And we had an assistant GM who would sit there with him. The assistant GM would sit there with him and kind of coddle him and, you know, tap him on the shoulder without saying, hey, dude, how about getting in the dugout with your teammates, right?
Yeah.
And so I brought this up to Stearns. And I said, this is a huge problem because now younger players, who we have younger players on the team, they're seeing this. And your guys are allowing this. And he goes, well, those players need to learn that they're not Juan Soto.
All right. So I've spoken to some others around the league. And I do know one person told me that in their organization, some of the better hitters were always going back into the clubhouse to look at at-bats and work on things in between at-bats. If you remember on ESPN, it might have been last year, the year before, Kyle Schwarber actually talked about during ESPN broadcast his process as the DH, how he would go in to the runway and work on staying fresh and working on his at-bats and looking at video. I mean, it's part of it. And with the video availability and all the information, I mean, is that taking away from the game and the camaraderie and the dugout and all that? If it's game 7 of the World Series, I don't think, you know, they're going to be doing their process, but I don't think they're going to be in the same mindset if it's a weekday game in the middle of a road trip somewhere. Maybe that's part of it. This isn't Little League or Sandlot where you're sitting there and going, in between pitches, and you had to, these are professionals that are trying to compete at the highest level against pitchers who are very tough to hit. I don't know if this is as big of a deal. Now, were there other things about Soto not being, you know, the 24-1 that Steve Phillips famously created with A-Rod many, many years ago? Is he doing a 24-1? I don't know. I think at the end of the day, it'll be up to Lindor and Soto to be able to set the example. Now, Stern's saying those guys need to understand they're not Juan Soto. They're not. But they're looking at that and saying, you know, how can I, you know, does that create like kind of like these silos by, well, if he's going in and doing this, do I go in and work on things the same way? Well, if you work on things the way Juan Soto does, you know, certainly that's the guy that you want to emulate in terms of his offensive output. But it's an interesting comment. Chavez thought it was a problem. Stearns didn't. Again, the manager's not going to David. Chavez is. It's another indictment on Mendoza. So almost seemed like things were kind of coming all away from Mendoza at this point. He wasn't keeping the clubhouses clean. And that's one of the biggest, we've talked about it, one of the biggest parts of the job. Keeping the clubhouse clean. Now, there's two more clips I want to get into, and then I'll just wrap up because I want to get to I want to get to your comments, your emails. Now, the criticism of Stearns, this clip about the phone call, and we've heard Adam Ottavino say himself that he didn't think Stearns was a great communicator. So let's listen to this clip.
That's right. Yeah.
And when you get let go,
yeah,
it's the perfect encapsulation of all the stuff that you just talked about.
Yeah, in which I knew this was coming. I knew changes were coming. I didn't know the whole staff was going to be let go. And he calls me. And I said, hey, David, what's up? And we talked about this, I think, before, too. And he goes, not having a good day. I said, okay, what's up, dude? He goes, well, we're going to go in a different direction. And I go, okay. And he goes, and he hangs up the phone, right? And I'm thinking to myself, like, man, like there's no, you know, thanks for what you did. Thanks for the hard work. Like, and coaches, man, they put in the hours. Like, as a coach, I'd never been so exhausted in my life those 4 years I was coaching. Yeah. And just kind of the lack of personal connect, gratitude, appreciation. For me, it's just, you know, well, we're just going to move on, and it is what it is. And, you know, that was the fourth strike for me, you know, of like, this isn't the dude. This isn't the right guy. I don't know where it came from. I don't know who built him up. You know, I heard a reporter ask him yesterday, have you thought about stepping down? And he gave his smirk, and he's like, no. And it's like, well, he stepped down before. He stepped down in Milwaukee.
So Chavez goes on to allude that there's something more to him stepping down in Milwaukee that we don't know about. Again, not interested in talking about that. This is a little bit of a fair criticism. Stearns, to me, is a good public speaker. He's an intelligent guy. He gives you some meat and potatoes. He's pulled back a lot, but he speaks in highly educated GM speak. See, Andy Green is an educated guy, but what I've seen of Andy Green since he took over as manager is he's pretty straight. He's a big-time straight shooter, and I like straight shooters, and I think we're so afraid of being transparent and honest because of criticism or social media or the media playing gotcha. Well, you said this, and then you did that because we don't want to tie ourselves into one thought process. Sometimes just like at that moment, this is how I feel, and you could always caveat any of your comments, but there's always this fear that it's almost like a legal document where you have to put all these disclaimers on what you say, so they don't want to say it at all, and they say word salad, GM word salad. Stearns is becoming more GM word salad, especially since they've started to struggle, and I think that delivering bad news, that's one perspective of Chavez saying how bad news was delivered. You go back to the old Moneyball, Billy Bean, hey, you've been traded. This is the information of your new team. Thank you for your service. Move on. I mean, that is a good way of being direct and quick, but you want to also have a human element. Hey, sorry things didn't work out, or this is a great opportunity we feel for both of us. You know, you want to be transparent and sincere. And one of the things that former ballplayers from all eras have told me when I've spoken to them is they just hated being lied to, and there's a lot of cowardly conversations. Like, they'll just blow smoke or give some BS reason why you're getting sent down, or lied to deflect some kind of confrontation about their role or their standing in the organization, and it winds up pissing them off anyway. So I agree with Chavez. This the theme here is, and Ottavino has said it, now these are guys on the way out the door, his communication is not great. So something to look out for a little bit. Now, the thing that I thought was that really hit me the most, and I think I took the most seriously from Chavez, was his conversation with Stearns and some players about the hitting philosophy. So let's go to that clip.
I want to get this story, and then I want to get into what was actually going on in the clubhouse and with the staff. But yeah, Tell the story about when you got let go by Stearns and how weird and just like, so awkward it was.
Yeah, so I'm gonna build up to that first.
Okay, cool.
Let me take this back to the very beginning.
Yes.
So when he was hired, Carlos decides he wants me on staff. He wants me to be a hitting coach. Great, cool, whatever. This is me after becoming a bench coach, right? Which I had aspirations of managing. Bench coach was where I really wanted to be. And I said, Carlos, I want to be on your staff. Whatever you need me to do, let's go. So Stearns calls me, and we're talking about my salary. And as a bench coach, I had a certain salary, and he goes, well, I'm going to have you take a pay cut this year because you're, and I'm going to my, to me, that's the first, and we're not talking about like, we're talking about 30, 40,000, right? For me, it's not the money. For me, it's the message you're sending, right? You just came off of a $50 million deal, right? The Mets aren't struggling for money, and you're going to ask me to take a pay cut. How about just say, hey, we're going to keep your salary the same. We're happy you're on staff.
That's
100%. Let's go. Right.
Handle people.
So that was red flag number one. Red flag number two is during the next season, I had players coming up from AAA telling me that the hitting coach was telling players that the only way they can get to the big leagues is to pull the ball in the air and try to hit homers, right? And so, okay. And the reason why this hit hard for me is because the hitting part is a reflection on me, right? So I can't control, you know, what somebody else's thoughts, what they're telling our players, and they come up and I'm...
All right, you got the point there. Now, that's legit. And that's why when you say fire the hitting coach, fire this guy, fire that guy, it's got to be an organization-wide philosophy. and Chavez didn't fit in. Now, you want to criticize the organization philosophy? Totally different conversation. I have a hard time believing that it's just that. I know they're about hitting the ball hard and launch. Not maybe. The launch angle is a really uneducated way of putting about it. They're about hitting the ball hard. And by all intents and purposes, if you look at the Mets, even by the big league club, they hit the ball pretty hard. The metrics are there. Now, hitting the ball hard at 110 miles an hour right at the shortstop is an out. Is there situational hitting being taught? You see a lot of things that you don't like, especially last year, late in the year, I talked about it. You got a runner on third, nobody out, and you got guys swinging from their heels instead of just trying to drive them in, going the other way or trying to make contact. You got guys in big spots, particularly Francisco Alvarez, not working counts, just trying to swing from the heels. If you're just teaching them how to hit hard, the ball hard and launch it to get to the big leagues and hit a home run and not about working the count and the other nuances of hitting, I have a problem with that. I also find it hard to believe that you could produce what we've seen in a small sample size of A.J. Ewing and Benj, and that the whole organization in this front is bad. Now, it definitely is a conversation where the Mets prospects have not developed. Four that they hold over, Mauricio, Vientos, Alvarez, and Beatty, are a mess. Benj and Ewing are the newer guys that were drafted late in Epler, but their development has been strictly in the Stearns regime, are pretty good. So does that say something? I guess we'll find out. But this is something to look towards. And as long as Stearns is here, it ain't changing. So forget about complaining about it. All right, the one last thing, and I think this is actually, before I get to his solution, I'm not even going to play the clip about his solution. I'll just talk about it. But he talks about the player's part in their own development. And I'm so big on this because a lot of times in conversations on social media or in different baseball conversations I have with friends and family, oh, what's the coach doing? Oh, you know, this team is not hitting. Where's the hitting coach? He's a resource. It's not a video game with a joystick. He's not a manager that can yell and scream and dictate, I want you to do this. He's a resource. So listen to what Chavez says about the hitting coach in particular.
He said the other day, we're looking for our coaches to get the maximum out of every player. And first of all, let me take this back as a player that played for a long time. Not one time did I ever blame anything negative on any coach. Was never a hitting coach. When I was in a slump, wasn't a hitting coach. Wasn't if I was in a fielding slump. It was me. You got to be, take ownership. You got to be a pro and understand, like, these guys are men. They're responsible for their own. I was responsible for my own career.
Accountability.
Who I listened to, that was up to me. And that was part of, you know, my decision making of my performance. But my performance was me, right? And I had coaches help me along the way and all this. But not one coach did I ever go, man, this guy screwed me up. And if it screwed you up, that's your fault. Yeah. If you're listening to people that aren't helping you, that's your fault. You need to reevaluate your team.
So at the end, basically just validates what I've been saying, that you need to have coaching up and down the organization on the same page. And because if you have different philosophies and different types of guys, they're not going to, it's not going to matter. It's going to make things worse. And maybe that's what the problem has been. Because think about it. Chavez has been around a few years. Beatty's been around for a couple of different managers. Stearns has been in building up the organization. Maybe the leftover prospects that have been to the big leagues before Stearns got here, maybe that's part of their problem. But it's on them. It's on Alvarez. It's on Beatty. It's on Vientos. Like, they need to figure out what they need to do within the construct of maybe what the team wants to stay in the big leagues and be successful and be the best version of whatever they're supposed to be. Because right now, if you just listen to the team and you're, you know, got a 650 OPS, you're not going to be in this league. Vientos is a guy that looks destined to be on the 4A train. And Beatty too. Alvarez, he's a catcher and he's got power, and I think Alvarez is going to be a tease his entire career. But it would be interesting to see if the Mets got an offer for him. Someone probably tried to steal him. What would their return be? Would they bring him in because he's got some big league experience and maybe give up a top prospect that they're not sure about or that hasn't proven themselves yet? I don't know about that. So, Chavez, I'm not going to do any more clips. Chavez winds up basically his big solution is bringing in Theo Epstein. Let me, and I've heard friends of mine say this. Let me tell you something. Theo Epstein had a conversation with Cohen. He's got, I believe he's got ownership in the Red Sox at this point. He's living a really good life. He's done consultation for the league on rules changes. I know what people are saying. Hey, he broke two, not one, but two curses. And why not another one? He'd have to leave the Fenway Sports Group as an advisor. I don't know if he wants to do the day-to-day operations of baseball front office. I laid out the responsibilities the other day on the Cohen podcast I did of what a president of baseball operations does. It's a lot of work. You got to bring in your guy. And if you brought in Epstein, you're probably bringing him in to rip the thing apart like he did in Chicago. And I don't think they're there yet. And I'm not so sure Theo wants to do round three. His Hall of Fame resume is pristine. Does he want to tarnish it coming here and maybe falling flat on his face? And, I mean, he'd have to give up his ownership. I believe he's got some kind of, he says here, I think he's got some kind of ownership in the Red Sox, if I'm not mistaken. He is part owner of, he'll purchase an ownership stake in the Fenway Sports Group. He's going to have to give that up. And is Cohen going to give him a piece of the team? Come on. You think he's just going to give away a piece of his ownership like it's candy? He has 5%. The team could be worth $8 billion by the time he sells. You think he just wants to throw that money away? I mean, the Wilpons already have 5% ownership. Fred Wilpon, Cohen's got 95. Could he give up 5% or something? I guess. 1%, 2%, is that enough? I don't know what Theo's take is with the Fenway Sports Group. By the way, if there's losses, you got to pay into your percentage of losses. You want to do that too? Remember, ownership, if there's a cash call, ownership asks for that. All right, I've had enough. I went probably 15 minutes longer than I wanted to with Chavez. Let me get to the mailbag. So, all right, let's just do some mailbag here. Let's do 15 minutes of mailbag. This is a long show. It'll give you guys some content here a couple of days post-holiday weekend. A lot of bad weather coming up. Something for you to listen to instead of while you try to figure out when the next day of sun is. Joe over in the chat room writes, do you think the Mets are going to let Ewing play any second base at all? Let's see. Here's the deal, Joe. I don't know, and he's been a really good... And I'm trying to find his fielding metrics here, Ewing. He's got a good arm in the outfield. He's got really good range. I don't know what his second base... I haven't seen him play second base, what it looks like. Center field is a premium position. I don't see why you would take someone who looks to be a plus defender in center field and put him at second base. You want to try him a day or two? I think they kind of know what they have, and I don't know if they really want to try it at this point. But, I mean, he's a plus +4 defensive run saves so far since he came up. And that's pretty good. I mean, he's a good defensive center fielder. I don't know why you would take him out of a premium position and put him at second base. Keith writes, the 2027 draft. Hi, Mike. I arrived home yesterday from spending 5 days in Toronto and watching the Mets 3-game series against the Jays at the Rogers Centre. We had a great time in Toronto and at the games, but the reality is starting to set in that this is a lost season and the Mets need to be sellers at the deadline. It looks like the Mets are going to finish near the bottom of the league this year, which would normally mean picking towards the top of the draft. How does their current salary cap situation affect their draft ranking? Will they be penalized or are they protected since they most likely be drafting in the lottery? From everything that I've read, it's not 100% clear to me. He also writes that he'd like to try to sign Holmes to an extension and sell everyone over 27 years old, not named Lindor. The leftovers from the previous front office need to be moved too. This is a rebuild. So, Keith, here's what I do know. I agree with you, it is. So I looked this up, and let me find it here. Where is it? I had it. I'm finding something right here. I believe the answer is no. If you're in the top six, okay. So here it is. If the Mets finish with a top six lottery pick, that pick is protected. They keep it even if they're over the highest competitive balance tax threshold. In that case, the top pick penalty is applied to the next highest draft selection. So if the Mets win the lottery next year and they're one, they're not going to lose that. If the Mets' first-round pick falls outside the top six and they are above the competitive balance surcharge, their first pick is moved back 10 spots. So they have to have one of the six worst records in the league. Now, are they going to tank? I don't know. The pick number three, the Mets keep it. If they're pick number eight, it becomes 18. If it's number 12, it's 22. It's, you know, it's not, and they don't forfeit it. So that's what I know, Keith. I agree with the whole re-signing Holmes as well. So Sean writes, hey, Mike, the good. And he's writing about Stearns and Cohen. Here's the good on Stearns and Cohen. I have no doubt that the owner, Cohen, wants to put an incredibly competitive product on the field. Having spent the first 15 years of my Mets fandom with the Wilpons, I can't say enough positive about Uncle Steve. I believe he truly wants to have a winning team, and it's so refreshing over believing the owner truly wants to make a profit. As far as Stearns, I think that he may be in over his head. I agree that firing a president of baseball operations would be a bad touch for an incoming person, but I'm concerned he hasn't been honest with himself and his owner. I'm not confident in his ability to wear both the GM and player president of baseball operations hat. It seems he needs to admit that he's a bit overwhelmed and hire a GM, someone who can enhance his capabilities to run the personal management. Stearns has stepped down before Milwaukee, allowing for a sharing of roles, and he may need to admit he needs some help here. I'm not saying we burn him at the stake. I'm saying what I'm seeing currently is one guy spinning too many plates, and he needs to find the right guy to hand off a big portion of the expectations to. This doesn't excuse him from responsibility. Ultimately, it's his job to say he needs help. But if the Mets hire a manager and a GM this offseason, I'd be encouraged. So it goes back to the whole Epler comment that Chavez made. Now, they have two assistant GMs. What are they doing? Maybe they're part of the problem. Ed Brizuela has been with him since, I think I say his name right, since his Milwaukee days. So remember that. You know, Keith, you could be right. I mean, sorry, Sean, you could be right. But part of what you have to question is that he's had one of the guys with him that has been with him since he was with the Brewers. Exposing Chavez. Andy writes, exposing Chavez. I recently listened to Eric Chavez's podcast and wanted to share my takeaways regarding his comments on Stearns and the current state of the Mets. So let's see. I haven't read this yet. And I made my comments. So this, let's see if Andy is aligned with me. Chavez made several claims I believe are factually inaccurate or logically flawed. Stearns' track record. Chavez claims Stearns hasn't accomplished anything prior to the Mets, ignoring his successful tenure and turning the Brewers around. He also suggested Stearns' childhood Mets fandom is a negative, though it's unclear how that correlates to job performance. Yeah, I didn't bring that up. That was weird how he says, well, is being a Mets fan a good thing because of all the losing and challenges that the franchise has had over their 60 plus years. Like, to me, that's a good thing. He understands what he's getting into. See, that I thought was weird too. I didn't even bring that up. I don't know why he did. Trade deadline. He argued Stearns should have traded for more starters and bullpen arms, yet the market was thin. Merrill Kelly was the top starter, moved and struggled, while Stearns successfully acquired two all-star relievers at Helsley and Rogers. I thought last year at the deadline for him to give up and Benj or Ewing would have had to been a deal for Duran or for top starter. I think by protecting his top prospects, he got the best haul he could get. Didn't work out. And, you know, a lot of the starters like Senga and Peterson and guys that you expected to at least give you quality starts let him down. Farm system and roster. Chavez incorrectly credited Epler for the 2025 farm system, overlooking the player development staff Stearns implemented. He also claimed the 24 NLCS team was Epler's, despite Stearns players making the majority of their roster. I agree. I think Epler had core players that were Epler and inherited. Epler inherited a team that, you know, had won 70-something games, fell down the stretch in 21 when DeGrom got hurt. Really inherited a team that was built by Alderson and maybe a little bit of Brody Van Wagenen. So I agree with that. Coaching staff, he complained about the firing of Hefner and Richardson, ignoring the Mets actually want to retain Richardson, that Hefner had six seasons to produce results. Richardson, it looks like it was a money thing and whatever. If Anton Richardson, the Mets can't overcome that, then we're in worse shape than you think. Again, you heard what Chavez said. Richardson taught these guys some really valuable things on base running, and I'm sure he was a help at first base. And I know now with the coach is not allowed to leave the box, it's actually, some have said that some of the advantages those coaches had in helping runners get leads or pickoffs, you know, kind of reading the pitcher, maybe even stealing signs. Not that you could do that really because you have the pitch comm, but maybe there's some kind of, you know, catcher the way he sets up or certain things they could pick up. They're not able to do that anymore. So Juan Soto, Chavez criticized the run prevention philosophy because Soto isn't subbed out for defense. Soto's been league average defensively, and removing his bat late in games would be counterproductive. I agree with that, Juan Soto. Maybe his future's at the DH, but I don't think you would take him out as a corner outfielder, especially in the left field, not a premium position. He should be able to field the position decently, that you don't have to sub him out. Maybe you want to in a tight game at ninth. You're up by one or two, but if the game is tied, you're losing a big bat. Organizational alignment. Chavez admitted that his hitting philosophy differs from the minor league staff. Having the major league hitting coach and farm system rowing in different directions is a significant red flag for the organization. All the top organizations in baseball preach lifting the ball. If they haven't, they are left behind and stuck in the Stone Age. Agree, Andy. I just think that hitting is more than that. So if that's all you're teaching, and we don't know, that's what Chavez said, bad. If that's a philosophy that is part of an overall hitting strategy, yeah, hitting the ball hard and lifting it, those are principles that all the great all-time hitters did. So, management style. He criticized Stearns for things that fall into Carlos Mendoza's purview, such as Soto's dugout presence and clubhouse culture. He suggested that a GM should pull a Billy Bean and chew out players as outdated at 26. Yeah, he told a story that I didn't even put that Billy Bean chewed him out about not running hard. Used Derek Jeter as an example. And, you know, I mean, Billy Bean was a presence, and Billy Bean was an all-timer by the time I think Chavez kind of came. I mean, Chavez was a young player. Billy Bean was that kind of presence. I mean, anybody who's read Moneyball and heard about Billy, you know, he's a rough guy. He's a tough guy. He didn't mince words. I don't know if that's certainly not Stearns. And again, that's really what the manager should be. And a lot of that story told you that Billy was more the manager of that team than maybe Art Howe, who was more of a docile and bland personality. Finally, he writes, while I agree with Chavez there was a hit job on Epler and that Stearns could improve his people skills, the rest of his points felt like those of a bitter former employee. It's hard to imagine another MLB team hiring him for a coaching staff given the outdated philosophies and public criticisms. I agree, Andy, and it sounds like we were pretty much on the same page. So we'll see. Josh Wright, Mike, I listened to Cohen's comments in your podcast. I think the most salient points are that Stearns is not going anywhere, at least for the next year. Furthermore, he made it pretty evident that he's going to be much more hands-on with moves going forward. I definitely think he's reining in some of Stearns' power. Can't disagree with that, James. Let's see. Jason writes, Mike, everyone gripes about $380 million payroll, and the narrative is measuring the wrong things. Unfortunately, most of Stearns' free agent bets, Polanco, Robert, Manai are underwater, and that's obviously the replaceable part of the job. Any owner with Cohen's resources can sign those players. The part that actually compounds is the cost-controlled core, and that's where Stearns is delivering. Ben, Ewing, McLean, and Scott are producing about 4.7 WAR as of this email, which was earlier in the week, for roughly $3 million in salary combined with this production is worth nearly $40 million, so it's a plus 37. I can understand that. That payroll figure, the Mets payroll completely hides that figure. You're not going to see, obviously, the WAR converted to dollars in the payroll. This isn't luck. It's a development engine Stearns built in Milwaukee, where he ran perennial contenders on the smallest budgets in baseball, and that's why the Brewers franchise is still sitting atop the standings on that model today. All the fans begging to fire him would be selling at the bottom of a development cycle, realizing the free agent losses and handing the next regime a farm system that's about to mature. The surplus is real, and it's appreciating. Let's also not forget, Brody drafted Beatty over Corbin Carroll. Epler drafted Colin Hulk over Kevin McGonigal. Stearns dropped top draft pick so far. Benj, already a major league component player at minimum. And Voit, who seems to be coming around high, performing. Not a Stearns fanboy, and he has flaws like any GM president of baseball operations. How many times do Yankee fans yell about firing Cashman? But obviously he has 2 years left, and I hope Cohen sees it through. He is going to see it through. Jason, you wrote this before the Cohen podcast, and I agree with you. I think if he could figure out the free agent part and maybe the balance between keeping some popular players versus overpaying like with Pete and maybe messaging that better, you might have something there. George wrote, Cohen pod and need to be honest. I recently listened to the Cohen interview with Sherman and Heyman and thought it was well done for the most part. Cohen seemed realistic and honest. He accepted blame and sounded disappointed about the current state of things, but I didn't sense any panic from him. He mentioned that Stearns will be back next year, but made it clear that he needs to perform better, which I believe is the correct takeaway. He said he might be more involved going forward, which could be good or bad. I don't understand why you criticize the Yankees more than the Mets. You have to be unbiased and honest. The fact the Mets are on pace to be 30 games under is mind-blowing and just doesn't feel right. The Yankees have managed to avoid a losing season since 1991, while the Mets seem to stack losing seasons like a game of Jenga. This fan base needs and deserves a consistent winner, and for you to be more truthful on this, please. You realize the Dodgers, Yankees, and small market teams are laughing at the fact Cohen and Stearns are struggling this much. The Dodgers ownership 6 years in, made 4 NLCS appearances, 2 World Series, 5 91 seasons. They took over a team with a bloated payroll, bad farm, aging roster, too, and fixed it right away. They had to wait 2 years for Friedman, too. So, listen, George, this is all fair. My criticism is not so much the Yankees. It's the fans and the media, you know, burying their struggles. The fans looking to steal everybody's players for nothing. It's not as bad as it used to be in the 90s, obnoxious. That's some fun on social media. But look, in comparison, and George, you're 100% right. In comparison, 6 years in where the Dodgers transitioned with the Guggenheim group and Magic Johnson and everything and the Yankees, the Mets are, and Cohen are, an unmitigated failure. And, you know, do the Dodgers have more than the Mets coming in? I'd have to go back and look how their farm was. Maybe they didn't have a great farm. Maybe they had a farm that was burgeoning. And then Friedman came 2 years in. I mean, some bad breaks the Mets have had. Mets have had a 100-win season, but they also were basing it on a lot of aging players. They've tried to develop and win at the same time, which, you know, maybe that's what the Dodgers did. So I agree. I mean, you have to study the Dodgers a little more to see, you know, where that comment falls into play. So anyway, went way over today. You got a lot of content, almost a 2-hour show here. So I'm going to wrap it up and, you know, hope everybody had a great holiday weekend. And we'll be more talking Mets throughout the week. I know we're headed into the All-Star break. We'll have to do our mid-season conversation. I'll have to see what comes up. Looking to maybe get a couple of guests on over the next few weeks. I've laid out for you where I see or what I'd like to see going to the trade deadline. I'm sure that will evolve as we hear more information and news going into the trade deadline. And then post-August 3rd, the trade deadline, it's going to be a rough final, you know, 6 weeks of the season playing out the string. And then with the whole lockout and labor strife potentially and labor negotiations, who the hell knows how we're going to be dealing with baseball, what our position on baseball is going to be. So this might be the last spirited conversation that we have for a while, so maybe we have to enjoy it. Hopefully not, but we'll have to enjoy it. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to the latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Come join me at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank our friends at the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.
For the